Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Dave Allen. We're going to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. Today is June 22nd, 2021. It's Tuesday. Good afternoon, Dave.
Hey, it is Tuesday. Hello, Melody.
Hello, hello, hello. And a great day here. And had a lot of rain today, but rain that we needed. So happy for that. And did it rain on Gold's Parade today? Well, let's go ahead and take a peek. It struggled, but, you know, that's all right. Well, why isn't it coming up? Well, maybe the rain is doing something to my computer. But you know what? We're soon July 4th, 1776 is the price for gold today. You know, it's landed on that price a couple times in the past couple of weeks. 1776 for gold in the New York spot price after market down 750. Silver is 2582. Couldn't keep the 26 level. It struggled today, but it's down 22 cents. 2582 is not bad. Platinum was up 20 bucks today at 1,080. Palladium was down 33, 2,626. The USDX today was down 0.16, 91.69. Crude oil was down 58 cents at 73.08. Paper markets today, you have all positive. You have the S&P 500 jumps for a second day. You have NASDAQ hits an all-time high amid Bitcoin's comeback are the big headlines today. The Bitcoin dropped below 30,000 and, of course, sparks fears of, you know, of a collapse in the crypto markets. But, and we have the Dow up 68 points at 33,945. The S&P was up 21 at 4,246. NASDAQ up 111 at 14,253. Europe was green pretty much across the board, along with Asia, except for the Hang Seng. That was down just a little over a half a percent. So nothing big. And but the big news, and everybody's talking about, of course, is Bitcoin was breaking 30,000, and you know, a little bit of a volatile streak today. And so we'll have to see if it's it fell for more than 11%, Dave.
And, it did.
It did, yeah. How about that? So we'll have to say something they talk about is the, was it the death cross that they talk about that is appearing in the Bitcoin?
That's what they say. Fall below 30, it'll keep on falling. I wouldn't get used to that idea, though. I mean, it's so volatile. There'll be lots and lots more ups and downs before that ever goes away.
Well, yeah, you know, because you hadn't got, well, you know what? People listen. When people say buy on the dips, they do. And that's what pushes the things up. So, you know, I'm sure every person out there who handles the cryptos are out there telling people buy on the dips, buy on the dips, buy on the dips, and which is what people do. They do what they're told. Sales of existing homes fall again. You bet. Sales of previously owned homes fell for a fourth straight month in May as higher home prices and, of course, these lean inventories weighed on home buying. Contracts closing decreased almost 10% or 1%. 1% from the prior month to an annualized 5.8 million. And this is all coming from the National Association of Realtors. Existing home sales continue to cool. And from the multi-year highs, robust demand paired with a limited supply of available homes, of course, have pushed selling prices way high. Home prices will likely remain elevated for some time. We have these builders are, you know, struggling to replace the deficit in existing homes with new builds, and they're also struggling for materials. They cite high material prices, supply shortages, and a limited number of skilled workers as ongoing challenges. The median selling price rose 24% from a year ago to a record 350. That's 350,000 in May. So, I don't know, Dave. Is it a bubble that will break?
We will see, won't we? I mean, there's still over 1.2 million homes for sale last month. That's up 7% from April, but still well below levels of a year ago. At the current pace, the realtors say it would take 2.5 months to sell all the homes on the market right now. Realtors tend to see anything below 5 months of supply as a sign of a tight market. So not quite there yet, according to those stats. But on average, properties in May remained on the market for an average of 17 days, just 17 days, a little over 2 weeks, matching an all-time low. Almost 9 out of 10 homes sold last month were on the market for less than a month. So now we know of sales of previously owned single-family homes declined 1% to a little over 5 million. So pretty interesting. Always something to look forward to on a Tuesday after month end, Melody.
Well, you know, it's amazing the housing, the prices around here, how they just skyrocketed. It's just like, but there's no place. You sell your house, but where do you go? You can sell your house at a high price, but then you have to pay the high price to buy one. So you may as well stay put unless you rent until the market. Yeah, there you go. Unless waiting until the market to break, and it will break because it's not any different. People are paying too much for these homes. The real value is not there. And they will pull back. It's not any different than 2008. 2008, you had the adjustable rates mortgages that, kind of opened the door to, the rest of, to exposing everything else. And it's no different now. It's just in a different, it's showing itself in a different manner. So people are buying homes they can't afford. They get caught up in the auction type mentality. They want the home, so they have to outbid the other person in order to get it. And the next thing you know, they're paying too much for a home that they shouldn't afford. So I don't know what he's doing again in the before the House Select Subcommittee. Jerome Powell, the federal chair, he's spending this afternoon there, and he's talking about, his before the House Select Subcommittee on the coronavirus crisis.
Talking about.
Yeah, but I mean, he hasn't said anything new than what he said last week. And so I can't see, he pretty much, is supporting the idea that the economy has shown sustained improvement. Economic activity, indicators of it, and employment continue to strengthen. So what did he really say? Anything new, Dave?
Did he say anything new? Mm-hmm. Probably not in general. But here's the thing. I mean, as you say, it's not what they do. It's what they say. And anytime they're scheduled, Powell or any of his Fed colleagues are scheduled to talk, particularly Powell, people's expectations. Yeah, I mean, he's the E.F. Hutton of the new millennium. But the people start to expect certain things and or look for certain things. And, any new talk of rate hikes or tapering the bond buying, I think in that respect, he disappointed some and not others. Largely, I mean, the paper market investors were probably pretty satisfied. He got a little specific, but nothing overwhelming. I mean, the most interesting, I think, part of his prepared testimony was his report on the Fed's four pandemic emergency programs, which we won't cover here, but it is available at federalreserve.org. I think it's on their homepage, or it was this morning anyway. That's worth looking at in terms of the hundreds of billions that were authorized total in these four programs, compared to what the Treasury actually gave and what the Fed actually provided to small businesses, municipalities, you know, whatever the program was. So anyway, perhaps besides the, you know, meeting people's expectations about the market per se, I think were his comments just about income inequality, just, you know, saying that, you know, the economic downturn hasn't fallen equally on all Americans, and those least able to shoulder the burden have been hit the hardest. And of course, he said explicitly the Fed, you know, the Fed's goal is, you know, monetary policy that improve economic outcomes for all Americans. Well, you know, to that extent, I guess he said what he had to say, but here's a case where more than what he says, Melody, is what the Fed will do about that.
Well, you know, the New York Fed president, John Williams, he said yesterday, like right now, he thinks, and this is the debate about whether tapering the bond buying program, the Fed's bond buying program. And he said yesterday, right now, he thinks that the attention is on the taper. You know, Dave, these guys can't do it. And they're only talking about it. The Fed's policy setting, the FOMC, which Williams sits upon, has begun discussing whether it would be appropriate to begin scaling back on these on the bond buying program. $120 billion of treasuries each month and agency mortgage-backed securities, $120 billion a month. Officials have said it will continue buying at that pace until the economy has made substantial further progress toward its employment and inflation goals. Williams says we have made progress for sure since December of last year. He still doesn't think that it's close to the substantial further progress that we set out. At the conclusion of the two-day policy meeting last week, the FOMC published updated quarterly projections showing the majority of policymakers expected it would be appropriate to begin raising the central bank's benchmark federal funds rate in 2023. It's and the emphasis on the word expected, not that they actually would start to raise rates, Dave. I mean, you know, does everybody forget even before we closed everything down? They were screaming about lowering the administration. Trump's administration was screaming to Powell about lowering the rates. I mean, it's they can't raise them. But, hey, that's my opinion, Dave.
Well, you know what? I like that opinion, Melody. 7 of the 18 on the FOMC, the voting members expected it would be, voting and non-voting, expect that it would be appropriate to begin raising the rate as soon as next year. But again, that's expected it would be appropriate. This is a time to look closely at their words about what they say and what they don't say. And that's where I think these computer algorithms of the stock market traders really screwed precious metal investors last week after the Powell press conference. Because, I mean, if they had followed his words carefully, you know, I think they wouldn't have overreacted. Although some people say, well, they just can't help themselves. After all, they're computer programs. Well, remember, computer programs are programmed by humans. At least today they are. not sure how it'll work when AI created entities begin to have more of a mind of their own. But today, you know, it's human programmers. We can regulate that. We can debate about to what extent we should, but we can regulate that. And you know, the markets can be made fairer for small retail investors like you and me. In any event, you know, he thinks, well, inflation's on track to exceed 2%. Well, it is more than 2%. In fact, you know, depending on who you talk to and whose methodologies you believe, it's, you know, anywhere between, you know, could be as low as 6 and as high as 11 percent, and has been for some time. But that's another story. Recent Labor Department report on consumer prices showed inflation of 5% in the 12 months through May. That's the fastest pace of price increases since 2008. So William sees the sharp rises in prices we've seen in the past few months as mostly temporary. So after inflation being at 3% or so this year, he adds, both core and overall inflation rates will come back down next year to around 2%. La-di-da, Melody.
La-di-da.
Yes.
In their world.
Fedworld. You know, hey, there we go. The Universal Studio. Are you listening? Fedworld.
Well, you know, we talked a lot about this really before last year, and it was all about us, and we saw big gains in the stock market. It was always about the stock buybacks, which I think we both think it should be illegal to do so, but hey, it doesn't matter. And the earnings environment that is going so well for these big companies, the announcements for new stock buyback, I mean, it's a record pace. This is incredible, and we'll finish this up when we come back from the break. S&P 500 companies have approved plans for a whopping $500 billion worth of stock buybacks since the beginning of the year, just through mid-June. That's a record, folks. And it's worth noting that Apple and Alphabet accounted for $90 billion and $50 billion, respectively, of those announcements. And my announcement is we're heading into a break right now, so we'll be back to finish up that. That's astounding. We'll be right back.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TeamUpRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. We got a great little special today. It's probably one of the least expensive ways to buy your silver. We offer it all the time in packages. And of course, that's 90% silver. These are silver quarters. This is a $50 face value. So with a $50 face value, you'll receive, 200 quarters? And we're also going to include a free Silver Eagle in this package. This package is also going to include shipping. So the package is $1,175. That's $1,175. It's about 35, almost 36 ounces of silver that you'll receive. And that's not including the Silver Eagle, so you'd be receiving almost 36, 37 ounces of silver. And it includes the shipping costs, $1,175. So this normal package, our prices are low, so it's really hard to give you really huge savings. But this package would run closer to $1,215. So not a bad saving. So give us a call at 1-800-375-41. Basically, the savings is the Silver Eagle. You're getting a free Silver Eagle, and they're close to $40. So, you know, it's a great little package, 90% silver, $50 face value, one free Silver Eagle, and it includes your shipping, $1,175. So give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And these supplies, these little packages are limited. So you have to give us a call right away. 90% silver is a great way to, buy silver. It's a little less expensive than buying the 1 ounce Silver Eagles. What's really nice about the 90% silver, I mean, you don't want to do this, but in an extreme emergency, you can still take it to the store and spend it. So be careful it doesn't get mixed up with your other change. And you only want to do that in a very extreme emergency. Or maybe if you're buying eggs with your farmers, you might want it. There's been gas stations across the country here and there. I hear people say they had signs on their door saying that if you paid with coinage prior to 1964, either you get discounts or you'd pay 10 cents for your gasoline or whatever. So
hear
it is
that,
widely.
Bitcoin?
Yeah, I know.
Go away.
I know. Who would want? Well, anyway. So give us a call, 800-375-4188. Coming into the break, we were talking about how Apple and Alphabet have are accounting for $90 billion and $50 billion, respectively, of announcements of company stock buybacks. And what does that do, Dave? When company buys back their shares, what happens?
It dilutes their value. It makes them appear to be worth more because there are more shares of their stock out there. I mean, it's amazing. Analysts expect companies to follow through with these plans and execute over $725 billion in buybacks this year, up 35% from $537 last year. Stock buybacks accounted for about half of the earnings growth for companies in 2018, and essentially all of it in 2019. No word about 2020, but I bet you all of it as well. Now, this is the only thing companies are spending money on. I mean, capital expenditures, R&D, and M&As are all expected to be above their pre-pandemic levels. I mean, corporate cash flows are pretty gosh darn strong right now. And business confidence is higher than it's been in some time. And so America's, particularly the bigger companies, are happy, and then some, to shovel cash to their shareholders. I guess the moral of this story is, Melody, if you can't find employees to fill all the job vacancies to boost your productivity and earnings, might as well use the best artificial earnings booster going, stock buybacks.
And, you know, so the whole stock market, I mean, it's just like anything else when we talk about inflation and we talk about the unemployment numbers. It's equations that aren't real. So what, you know, if you didn't have company buybacks, where would the stock market really, where would the S&P really be?
That's a good question. That's, I mean, you pose a very good question. We'll have to look into that. There's got to be some analysis out there, excuse me, that may provide a reasonable estimate. Hard to be accurate on that because it depends on certain assumptions, but glad you asked it.
Yeah. So that's your assignment, Dave.
Written down.
All right. All right. I'm really anxious to see if there's a way that we could, you know, get, you know, just a, you know, for every $1 billion or $500 million that's spent, it makes the S&P 500 10% higher or something like that, you know. In related news, you have merger and acquisition activity in the U.S. That's on pace to substantially surpass last year's total deal value. And I get it because it was 2020. Nobody was doing anything last year. You know, it's a sign that the economy is improving. From 2016 to 2020, the annual U.S. deal value totaled an average of $1.8 trillion. Just through May of this year, U.S. deal value already amounts to $1.4 trillion. So, Dave, from 2016 to 2020, it was 1.8, and just through May was 1.4 trillion, right?
Yeah.
So if that would be a sign of inflation, would it not, to some degree?
Well, you know, by definition, it sure seems to be on the surface of it, right?
I would think. Part of it, accounting powerhouse, because what really is different from 2016 to 2020? You know,
prices.
Markets were going higher. So, but yeah, through May of this year, the U.S. deal value already accounts. I already did that. So anyway, what else would you like to add, Dave?
Through the end of May, I mean, there were 54 mega deals of at least $5 billion in size that had been announced, matching the number of all mega deals last year. Since then, Medline unveiled the largest pure leverage buyout since the financial crisis, the Great Recession. Deals between $1 and $5 billion are also picking up. I mean, 200 transactions in the first 5 months, compared with an average of 230 annually in the previous 5 years. So one thing we know, I mean, private equity firms are more active than ever. 39% of this year's deals volume so far, compared to the mid-high 20% area in the previous 3 years, and they're still sitting on loads of capital to deploy. I suspect Michael Milliken is smiling somewhere, Melody.
Well, wasn't he a crook?
Yes. Yes, a leveraged buyout, dude.
Yeah, he's a crook.
So just
but
real
he's
quickly.
Back in the business, so it doesn't matter anymore. At least he did go to prison, but he was welcomed back with open arms, right?
Shouldn't have been. No. Should have been excluded forever.
Absolutely.
Hey, just real quickly before we move on, I won't dwell on it, but just to give you an idea, a study was done in 2019 that showed this, at that point, at least based on an analysis of the market, the S&P 500 from 2011 to 19, that the market would be 19 or would have been 19% lower had it not been for buybacks in that period. We'll put that together for Thursday's show and maybe even base Friday's blog on what we find.
Oh, super, super. ExxonMobil, they're preparing to reduce headcount at its U.S. offices between 5 and 10% a year. And, I mean, that's going to be in the next 3 to 5 years.
But that's every year, 5 to 10% a year.
That's 10% a year.
So that could be 50% over 5 years.
Oh. The cuts are going to target the lowest rated employees relative to peers. And for that reason, will not be characterized as layoffs. While such workers at Exxon are typically put on so-called performance improvement plan, many are expected to eventually leave on their own. Now, this year's evaluation is happening now, but affected employees have not yet been notified. So where employees are not contributing to their highest ability, they may need to participate in an improvement plan. That just sounds funny. We're going to put you on an improvement plan here.
Oh, my.
The plan is separate from Exxon's announcement last year that it will cut 14,000 jobs worldwide by 2022. So there you have it, Dave.
Tough time for Exxon. I mean, they're still dealing with the fallout from their annual meeting last month when shareholders rebuffed top management and replaced a quarter of the company's board over various concerns. Exxon had 72,000 employees globally at the end of last year, of which 40% worked in the U.S. So that equates to a reduction of between 1,450 and 2,900 jobs under this new plan, again, on top of the 14,000 reductions already announced.
Let's see. Where do we want to go from here, Dave? We talk a lot about, wealth inequality a lot on this program. You do. I don't. You do. That's your little pet peeve.
Guilty as charged, I'm afraid.
I know it. And, because there is no such thing as a trickle down, and that's what's happening. And this has a lot to do with death tax too. A lot of people are against that, but to some degree, it's not like it has changed. When it was putting the little farmer out of business and the families were, yes, that was wrong. But it has changed over the years. But a new study shows that the wealth of America's 50 richest families, dynasties, have soared at 10 times the rate of the typical U.S. family over the last four decades. Now, this was from the Institute for Policy Studies. It's a think tank out of Washington. And finds that the collective wealth of the richest 27 families on the Forbes Billion Dollar Dynasties list and Forbes 400 list grew by a little over 1,000% from 1983. So in inflation adjusted dollars, it grew from $80 billion to $903 billion over that same 38-year period. Wealth grew less than one-tenth of that, just 93% for the typical American family. So we know who all the wealthiest families are. Yeah, the Waltons, the Marseilles, the Cargill, Louders, of course, their wealth soared even more. But anyway, that's all I have. What do you have to say on that?
2,500% the five wealthiest families, 50 wealthiest worth a total of $1.2 trillion. Listen to this. This is what got me. This really stood out. The 65 million families at the bottom economic half of all households shared a combined total of $2.5 trillion. So the 50 wealthiest were worth half of the bottom 65 million households. That is astounding inequality. It certainly goes beyond that. We can get into the power dynamics And not the physical things it buys, but the power and influence. And it just, I think, accounts for so much cynicism in American politics and our low rates of voter turnout. I mean, you see a number like that, Melody, it's like, well, what can I do to affect change? You know, when you've got not these families per se, but, you know, any family or business or group of business, you know, that combined their income. You know, it's like the little guy doesn't have a chance. So anyway, that's all I have to say.
I mean, the little guy does have a chance. He just has to go out there and work. I mean, we're not all supposed to be on the same level. I mean, it's just not yet.
No,
and I do agree.
I'm not calling for that.
And I do agree that, you know, hey, it doesn't trickle down, but we all know that. You know, and we don't. Where I have a problem is the subsidies and corporate welfare for these corporations. That's what needs to stop.
Yep.
You know, and, you know, the corporations can do, corporations and these families can do whatever they want, but they, and another problem is, and you're right, the amount of political power and how they can change. I mean, we know Michael Bloomberg, he puts tons of money into these local, and so do all these families. They put tons of money into the local elections and behind their, you know, their personal politicians that they want to have elected. And it does change the dynamics of those communities. And that is wrong. But again, then we're back to campaign finances that, you know, nothing's going to change. It never changes. You know, they put forth some sort of a bill, you know, and, you know, it just makes people feel happy. It doesn't change anything. You know, there's so many loopholes and so forth. They're not going to cut off their flow of funds into their campaigns and everything. So, yeah, that's the corruption. And to me, that's so to that degree, yes, it's to see the amount of wealth that these same families and the how they can influence, you know, our livelihoods and how they influence our policies, our government policies, and our rights and liberties they influence. So, yeah, you're absolutely correct. That's wrong. And but no one's going to do anything about it. And they're not going to trickle it down. So, but what we're going to trickle into is our break. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival. Just one more time.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseVoicesOfIntegrity.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, one more time. Welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Melody in the office. This last segment taking care of client business. Caller at 1-800-375-4188. 800-375-4188. Last week, if you were tuning in, Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs talked about the FDA's dubious approval of that new Alzheimer's drug. I think you pronounce it Aduhelm. And you might expect someone like Mariah Robertson to applaud last week's endorsement. The Johns Hopkins physician has seen the toll it takes on her patients, particularly her own mother, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's at age 57. Her mom, Louise Dreisinger, was a senior officer at a local bank who started forgetting the details of projects and showing up late to meetings, straining relationships with her coworkers and friends. Later, she lost motor skills and the ability to perform daily tasks, which was especially painful to watch because she took such pride in her self-reliance. Once Dreisinger required round-the-clock care, Robertson, then in her 20s, helped provide it while juggling graduate studies in public health. By the time her mom died in 2012, Robertson had enrolled in medical school to become a doctor and change the ways we treat people with dementia. Aduhelm, the new Biogen drug that got clearance from the FDA last week, is supposed to offer that kind of change. It's the first federally approved drug that seeks to slow the underlying biological process of Alzheimer's rather than simply reduce its symptoms. Nobody thinks it's a cure, but advocates say it can stall disease progression and may be the first in a series of new treatments that will turn Alzheimer's into a manageable chronic condition. Robertson, however, takes a very different view. She says the scientific evidence comes nowhere close to justifying the claims on the drug's behalf, let alone the $56,000 Biogen plans to charge for a year's worth of treatment. And that comes out to about $4,700 a month, each and every month. Robertson's thinking about her patients, she said, but also about herself, because the kind of early onset Alzheimer's that her mom suffered is thought to have a genetic component. Now, Robertson's sentiments are said to not be unusual. Scientists across the country have expressed dismay over the FDA's decision and the process that led to it. That includes the agency's ignoring the advice of its outside advisory committee that voted virtually unanimously against approval. The FDA commissioners vote against recommendations of its advisory commission just 20% of the time. Three members of the advisory committee, in fact, have since resigned in protest, with one of them calling the FDA decision probably the worst drug approval in recent history. Now, Aduhelm is not the first drug to generate this kind of controversy, but it may prove to be the most financially consequential given the price and number of Americans who could end up taking it. That in turn could reshape ongoing political debates over whether to reform the FDA itself, whether to enact legislation that would finally force down the price of prescription drugs in the U.S. The common thread linking those debates is a long-running argument over whether giving the government more sway over the pharmaceutical industry would dampen innovation. The answer, according to a variety of political and big pharma advocates, is yes, it would, that holding drug approvals to higher standards or restricting manufacturers' ability to set prices would likely lead to fewer medical breakthroughs. But if Adahelm's critics are correct, its story may end up demonstrating why that argument is flawed. I think the innate desire for scientists, particularly among big pharma, not just there, but in general, to discover new things, not to mention cure big diseases, and of course there's the good old profit motive, are strong motivating factors that I think will rain on the glass is half empty theorist in that regard. Excuse me. Now, in sort of a related topic, Dr. Kingsley Chin was little more than a decade out of Harvard Medical School when sales of his spine surgical implants took off. Chin has patented more than 40 pieces of such hardware, generating $100 million for his company, Spine Frontier. Yet, the company's success arose not from the quality of its goods, at least according to government officials, but because it's paid kickbacks to surgeons who agreed to implant the highly profitable devices in patients over the years. In March 2020, the Department of Justice accused Chin and his company, Spine Frontier, of illegally funneling more than $8 million to nearly three dozen spine surgeons across the country through sham consulting fees that paid them handsomely for doing little or no work. Medical industry payments to orthopedists and neurosurgeons who operate on the spine have risen sharply. That's despite government accusations that some of these transactions may violate federal anti-kickback laws, as well as drive up healthcare spending in general and put patients at risk of serious harm. These payments come in various forms. There's royalties for helping to design implants, to speaker fees for promoting devices at medical conferences, to stock holdings in exchange for consulting work. Not bad for a couple of hours or a day's work. Health policy experts and regulators have focused for decades on pharmaceutical companies' payments to doctors, which research has shown can influence what drugs they prescribe. But far less is known about the impact of similar payments from device companies to surgeons. A drug can be readily stopped if it's deemed harmful, while surgical devices are permanently implanted in the body and oftentimes replace native bone that's been removed. Every year, a torrent of cash and other compensation flows to these surgeons from manufacturers of hardware for spinal implants, artificial knees, and hip joints. Over $3.1 billion from August 2013 through the end of 2019. These bone specialists make up a quarter of U.S. doctors who've accepted at least $100,000 or more, and two-thirds of those who've raked in $1 million or more from the medical device and drug industries last year. Now, much of that money is deemed to be compensation for consulting duties or medical research or royalties for inventing or fine-tuning new tools and techniques. Whatever the case, I mean, you've got industry whistleblowers and government investigators say that all that money changing hands can really corrupt medical judgment and tempt surgeons to perform unnecessary and costly operations. On the other side of it, they say, well, the patient has to sign a consent form. I'm not sure that cuts it. The case of Chin's company Spine Frontier is among more than 100 federal fraud and whistleblower actions filed or settled, mostly in the past decade. Interesting. Excuse me. Our latest American Survival newsletter hit the streets last night. If you're a subscriber, check it out. In addition to our normal array, you get Melody's weekly market update, Doug Nolan's credit bulletin blog, and Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. There's an article on nanoparticles in food. I also have a guest article by Pam and Russ Martins of Wall Street on Parade. Talk a lot on this program about that unknown black swan, that unpredictable and often unforeseeable event that could unravel, really unravel markets at any time. Now, sometimes exhausted at the possibilities, we're left asking ourselves, do we even know what we don't know? After all, to get the right answer, you have to ask the right question, right? Well, just 6 months ago, participants in a monthly survey conducted by Too Big to Fail Deutsche Bank were asked, what do you think are the biggest risks to global financial markets in 2021? These were the top half dozen responses. First, the virus mutates and dodges vaccines. 38% mentioned that. Serious vaccine side effects start to emerge. 36%. Enough people refuse to take vaccines, thus hampering back to work drives. 34%. The tech bubble bursts, causing fallout across global markets given their size. 33%. Central banks and governments pull back stimulus too early. 27%. And runaway money supply growth causes inflation to rise earlier than anyone expects, 23%. Today, a mere 6 months later, top investors' concerns include supply chain bottlenecks, labor shortages, inflation at the top of the list, and slower GDP growth. But in its latest monthly survey, Deutsche Bank was told by clients that among the top risks they see to the global financial markets are still these vaccine-related concerns I just mentioned. Now, it would be wise to remember that it's the risks that investors aren't thinking about that often do the most damage in markets when they happen. Indeed, I think it's Sam Rowe of Axios points out that investors may be confident that something expected to happen will actually happen. Yet the smallest amount of uncertainty will keep that eventual event from being fully priced into the market. See that particularly in the stock market. But what about the risks that didn't surface in that survey or that were considered by the less than 5% who responded to the question with none of the above? We ignore those least popular responses, I think, at our own risk because therein probably lays the black swan. We only have to look back to last year. Going into 2020, who among us ever imagined we'd face a global pandemic that would force large parts of the economy and countries all across the globe to literally shut down? It's this lack of expectation, that element of surprise, that leads this risk to be underpriced in the market and therefore caused the stock market to crash, especially like it did last March. But no one's suggesting that investors should start considering the unlikeliness of risks as they were, so they were likely to occur. Indeed, I mean, if investors were always overly worried about everything that could go wrong, risky assets might never be cheap enough. However, you should be aware of them at a minimum. This risk should be calculated and should be educated. But be aware of them at a minimum. To be aware is to be prepared, after all, and to prepare is to set yourself up for success, right? Now, until the past week or so, gold and silver were on a good upwards run after a slow start to the year. Yet their recent correction, I believe, can be attributed largely to how institutional and large retail investors are manipulating gold and silver ETFs. The paper forms of gold investment almost every day through their high speed computers and algorithms. Stocks have rallied almost unabated for over a year now, leaving many to wonder if the market's due for a big sell off. Last week's declines magnify those concerns. So what's coming next? Well, Jonathan Golub of Too Big to Fail Credit Suisse believes there are two big dynamics to consider and look at in the second half of this year. First, how long does the demand for goods and services outstrip supply, keeping inflation hot? And second, what's the path to a more normal pace of growth? As we know, persistent inflation and a disorderly slowdown or rebound are a recipe for market volatility. Golub is bullish, predicting the S&P will rally to 4,600 by the end of 2021 with what he calls a benign deceleration in growth. That's where the economy cools to modest but healthy growth and the market generates modest but healthy returns. RBC strategist Lori Calvesina is more cautious, seeing a little more room for stocks to move up, but not a lot. She says we could see a meaningful pullback during the second half of this year, amounting to as much as 8 to 9%. That would put the paper markets into official correction territory, or on the verge of it. Among other things, Calvesina cautions that measures of investor sentiment and positioning are at levels that signal the market has peaked and is about to slide. Too big to fail Bank of America strategist, Savita Subramanian, thinks the S&P will fall to 3,800 by year end. The bottom line, Calvesina says, the stock market is not in a place where it can absorb more bad news. And if that's true, that to the degree to which an event will rattle markets is inversely related to how much people are already thinking about it, well, get ready for a wild ride. And keep at least one eye peeled to the skies, because that dark formation just could be the black swan preparing to swoop down on our reality. Well, just like that, it's the end of the program. Thank you, Todd, for taking care of us. Back on Thursday, Butch will join Melody tomorrow, along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks for listening. Have a good evening, and please be safe out there. Bye-bye. If I'm not here.